That's the theme from Waldo Pepper there. That's the new movie that Robert Redford is in. It's 8:09 now. This is the Airline Program. In the show, we talk to you about anything you'd like to talk about. And today, we are going to be talking with an ex-Alaskan bush pilot. I know that a lot of people, when they get on the radio, like to say, "Hi, Mom," and "Hi, Dad." Hi, Dad.
Hi, son.
My dad is the ex-Alaskan bush pilot. And you're invited to join this conversation. All you have to do is call 672-1000. The area code is 703. And I guess we ought to start out by finding out why we went to Alaska in the first place. I'm just going to sit here and act like I never went.
All right, Russ. Well, thank you. Alaska seems to be an interesting place and a topic of conversation to many people. But what inspired us to go to Alaska was perhaps the desire to venture out and to see things while we were still young and to look this country over, and we decided to go to Alaska on vacation. This was back in 1959, and we started out in October. I was working at the time for Capital Airlines in Washington, D.C., and I just finished training and had received my commercial license and instrument rating. And we had spent some time trying to find work, but it seems that experience and old age crept in there, or the lack of experience, rather, and no one seemed to want to hire an old man with little experience. So we thought maybe our success might be a little better in Alaska, and we decided to look it over. So we took a trip. Since I was working with the airline, we had these passes, and we flew from Washington to Seattle, and then from Seattle on Alaska Airlines to Anchorage, which, by the way, was not our destination, but it happened to be second choice. We had an engine failure on our trip up. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I do. And DC-6, wasn't it?
It was a DC-6, right. And since we didn't reach our destination, we thought perhaps it would be good to look around Anchorage for a little while. And we decided to go on to Fairbanks later. And we talked with Avis rent-a-car man there, and he said we might be able to drive an automobile back if we could get to Fairbanks.
Okay, what we ought to do is describe where these cities are in relation to each other in the,
right.
The state of Alaska, too.
All right. Anchorage is west and south of Fairbanks, and it's at the end of the panhandle of Alaska. And Fairbanks is centrally located in Alaska. It lies between two great mountain ranges, the Alaska Mountain Range and the Brooks Range, which is north of Fairbanks. So it's about 300 miles by air, by road, over the Richardson Highway. It's about 439 miles. If you go through Tok Junction, I think the trip is about 100 miles further. So we wanted to see some of Alaska, and the best way to do that was to drive, and of course our funds were limited, but we did get an automobile from Avis. These cars were just trying to get them back to their home port. So we flew into Fairbanks and picked this automobile up, and then started to drive back to Anchorage on the Hart Highway, or the Richardson. And this is a most scenic drive. It's an awe-inspiring country, Alaska. Its scenes are fabulous. The colors are so vivid, and they're beautiful to see the variety of tones, and the sunsets and the dawn and the flowers. And of course, this time of year, it was in October, there was a light snow in Fairbanks. But the scene between Fairbanks and Anchorage perhaps is the most varied in that short a distance. One might not see as many different varieties of sights traveling from coast to coast in the United States as he would driving that short run from Fairbanks to Anchorage. Well, anyway, we proceeded to come down the highway, and all of our trip up and back didn't cost us much over $150. I think it was $87 for passes round trip. That was you and Debbie and Mom and I. And that was quite an experience. Well, we got back to Washington and decided that Alaska might hold a good opportunity for us. There were many things that we liked about Alaska. The cities and the towns were as modern as any towns that you might find in the States. It looked like the job opportunities might be better up there, and of course it did have a very scenic attraction, and this gave us quite a desire to go back. So, in July.
All right, we're going to go back. And go back to Alaska in just a minute. We're talking with Dudley Roberts, who is my father. I'm Russ Roberts. It's 15 after 8 o'clock now on the airline. We'll be back after this.
Kay Medford talks about her experience with cancer.
I like this man because he said, it's like a fork in the road. You have a tiger in back of you. You can't afford to wait. Whatever you do, do it right away. Well, I trusted this man so much, I took surgery, and I'm very, very lucky and very grateful. I always enjoyed life, the whole mystery of it, the whole nonsense of it. Look at this day, lilacs that came out overnight from the rain. It's incredible. And it just came back to me this weekend, how lucky, God, how lucky. I'd love if other people could be prevented from having it.
Today, thousands of people like Kay Medford have been saved from cancer through early detection and treatment. But we want to wipe out cancer in your lifetime. This is Hal Holbrook asking you to give generously to your American Cancer Society.
WJMA weather for Cuckoo, Orange, and Madison. Fair tonight, a low around 30 to the mid-30s. Increasing cloudiness tomorrow, a high in the 60s. Cloudy, a chance of rain tomorrow night and Tuesday. A low tomorrow night in the mid-30s to around 40 and a high Tuesday in the 60s. Today's high was 58 degrees. Right now it's 50 degrees Fahrenheit, 10 degrees Celsius. Relative humidity is now 46%. We're talking with Dudley Roberts, who is my dad. We're eventually going to get around to how he got into bush flying in Alaska. We've just found out how come our family decided to go to Alaska. It's now July in 1960.
Yes, thank you, Russ. Well, we decide to go back to Alaska, and we take off in a little Volkswagen Bug. You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
We packed it up, had loaded up from top to bottom, had the top with all of our gear on it, and had cases on the back, and off we go. 5,000 miles in a little Volkswagen Bug. Well, it took 10 days of driving, and we finally reached Alaska. And we first stopped at Anchorage. We thought perhaps this might be the best place to find a job and get into flying. This was my desire, what I had wanted to do.
And Anchorage was the biggest city.
It's the biggest city, and it was a childhood dream to fly. So this is our endeavor. But as things turned out, we arrived in Anchorage, and we rented a little house. It's about $50 a month, just with one room, just to get started. And I couldn't find a job. About 3 weeks went by, and finally, with Interior Flying Service, I got a job. Well, I thought this was a good thing. Oh, boy. Well, it didn't work out that way, though. That day, they needed a co-pilot to go along on this trip. We were going into Sperry Vaughan. It was a government installation, and we were going to bring back about 12 construction workers and their crew and their tools. And we had de Havilland Heron was the airplane we were going to use. It was a four-engine aircraft, not very big. It was under 12,500, but just about touched that gross.
How many passengers?
It was 12 passengers.
All right.
We took off from Anchorage on a flight plan and flew across the mountain. This was the Alaska Range, and they were, at this point of our flight plan, they were 9,000 feet. And it was drizzling rain, and it was in July now, but the weather was pretty cold. We crossed the mountain, and of course it was socked in everywhere. Couldn't see a thing. All we had was an ADF. And the captain was a little bit unsure, seemed to me like. He asked me questions about this instrument and that instrument and the radios that he had in this airplane, which he said, do you know anything about these? And he pointed to the VORs, and I said, well, yes. He said, we never use them up here. I know absolutely nothing about these things. He said, all we use is an ADF. Well, that didn't sit too well with me. I thought, well, what kind of a person am I with? Here we are on instruments and circling around up here, trying to find a hole to get down into this place. Well, finally, we did find an opening and dropped down through it, and this big four-engine airplane is big for that kind of work, I thought, you know, and hadn't had any experience like this. So we dropped down in between two mountains in a canyon, and wandering around through these crags and chasing that ADF needle back and forth and trying to dodge the cliffs in the meantime didn't quite set too well with me. I was a little shook up about this time. Well, finally we found the field. We chased that needle right in there, and there it was down below us, and it looked like it was inside of a teacup, and that's just about the way it was. We had to circle around and drop right down with full flaps and everything back, and there was no incident there. We had a nice dinner, and loaded up the airplane, and took off. Well, the weather was getting worse. We started back, and we were going to go back the same way we'd come, and there was no flight plan at this time because we were off airways. But during this time, the weather had worsened, and it began to ice. And we were loaded now, and we had to reach 11,000 feet to get over this 9,000-foot mountain. Well, we didn't make it over the mountain. The ice built up on the wings, and we had de-icers, de-icer boots, the old type that push out. Well, the ice hadn't built up too much on the wings, and I thought, well, he'll wait a little while before he cracks it. But unfortunately, he didn't wait long enough. And when he pushed the de-icers, it pushed this glaze ice right out off of the wing, and it made a shell, and the de-icers just worked inside this glaze ice. It didn't break it off. It wasn't heavy enough to break off. So there we were, loaded with ice. We got to about 7,000 feet, and that's all we could go. A few minutes later, my PDOT heater went out, and then the airspeed indicator quit on my side. Then about 10 minutes later, his went out. There we were, flying along there with no airspeed. Right on the verge of a stall, just hanging there, just shuddering, and not knowing what our airspeed was, of course. I guess he knew. We didn't crash and burn. I'm still here. But anyway, we couldn't get over the mountain. So we turned around, and rather than go back to the marker, to the ADF station, he takes off on a tangent, skirting the side of this mountain, the Alaska mountain range. We had to go along right beside that big mountain there. You know that big mountain. Biggest in North America. It spans a long way, but it goes up 20,320 feet. Well, I could just feel that thing right off my right wing. We couldn't even see the wing tips. That's how bad it was. And the wind was about 50 knots, and it was a headwind. But rather than give us a good starter and a marker position, he just branched off and started off up, churning along, not knowing where he was, just flying the ADF needle. Well, I calculated our speed and knew our ground speed was fairly slow, but he started screaming on the radio wanting a flight plan. And they were delaying a little. So he got panicky. Well, this didn't do me a bit of good. I began to get a little nervous.
Now, this is your first flight with this guy.
That's right.
And first flight with the whole airline.
Right, but I couldn't see a thing. Now, remember, this was all on instruments, and I couldn't see the ground, couldn't see mountains, wingtips, or anything. All I could see was the cockpit, and half the instruments were out on. Well, we finally made it back to the ADF, the low-frequency range, and turned down and came on in. This all took about 5 hours longer to go around this way. Of course, your mother was waiting at the airport, walking the floor, and his partner was there too, and he didn't help any. He didn't pacify her any. Every airplane that came in, he'd jump up and look and see if it was de Havilland. Well, anyway, this was 5 hours. Well, we got back all right. So I bid farewell and said, good day, and I won't see you anymore.
All right.
So that was my first introduction into Alaska flying, which was not a very happy experience, I might say. But we didn't stay long in Anchorage.
So then we decided to move to Fairbanks.
Right. This was about 3 weeks. It was raining, and I was getting despondent, you know, and the money was getting low, and so we decided to get out of there.
Okay. Let's pull it here for a second and tell the folks what we're doing. This is the airline show on WJMA, 26 after 8 o'clock. We're talking about flying in Alaska with my father, Dudley Roberts, who had about, I guess, a year experience, that year and a half flying in Alaska in the early 60s. If you'd like to join in this conversation, if you've been to Alaska too, have you ever flown up there or just lived there, give us a call, 672-1000, area code 703. So we're moving to Fairbanks now from Anchorage.
All right, we're in Fairbanks now, and we find us a little place temporarily to put our hat. And I go to the airport, and the only thing I could find was a job with the School of Aeronautics, the Alaska School of Aeronautics, flying. Well, that's flying, and I'd be the captain now. I can go and stay if I want to without having somebody else there at the controls. So our biggest student group was at a place southwest of Fairbanks, about 50 miles to the southwest, and it was called Clear. It was a radar installation. They were building this site, and it's one of the largest radar screens in the world, and it looks right out over Russia across the Bering Sea, and it's got a very slight angle to it.
And it's called BMUSE, right? Ballistic Missile Early Warning System, right?
That's part of it. Yeah. That was the major part. Of course, it had satellite stations all over, unmanned, but this was all going in at the time, being constructed. They tell me, I don't know how true it is, but they say that this antenna is so powerful, if an airplane flies within a mile in front of it, it'll disintegrate. So it must be quite a powerful antenna. We had a little old field down there. It was full of rocks about as big as your head, and this is where we did a lot of our student instructing. And we had a couple Super Cubs. This was a favorite airplane for bush flying in Alaska. Some of them had big wheels on them that you could land on sandbars and bounce over rocks and not hurt the airplane much. So it seemed like pretty good for a time. But one day, we were flying, making takeoff and landings at this little old strip, and all of a sudden I noticed no oil pressure. Well, great day. Pulled the power back on this thing. And fortunately, we were within reach of the field, and we set back in. Well, the mechanic didn't put the oil plug safety in, and the oil plug fell out. Well, that was the number one engine failure in Alaska. Well, that didn't amount to a whole lot. But things kept on going along for a few more weeks, and I didn't get any money. This man kept putting me off, and well, okay. So finally, I said, well, I can't do anything more for you unless I get some money. We had to live a little bit, and we were getting down pretty thin. So I quit, and just after I quit, he went bankrupt and lost his airplanes. So I finally got a job with Fairbanks Air Service, and this is where I did most of my flying with them. Now, this was an air taxi service, and we had regular flights from one point to another. I don't want the public to think that all of the flying in Alaska is hazardous or it's dangerous. These are just some experiences that I've had out of the hundreds of flights, of good flights. These are some of the things that happened in Alaska. Alaska's a big country. It's sparsely settled. There's very few villages there, and no electricity. You feel like you're all alone in the world. Some people say that it's kind of like on the backside of the moon. Of course, I don't think that's so at all. But you get that feeling, a very lonely feeling when you're up there flying. You look out over this wasteland. It's deltas and mountains here and tundra. Alaska is a beautiful country, but yet it's also a fearful country when you're flying. You think that if you go down, that you're all alone, there'll be nobody around. Of course, if you stay on your course, and you do go down and you're overdue, generally within a few hours somebody will be out looking for you. But Alaska's been grossly misrepresented in the past. The tales about Alaska have come back here, and most people think it's a wasteland with nothing going on, nothing but Eskimos and Indians up there eating blubber, whale blubber, and seals. But truly, Alaska is a civilized country. And aviation to the Alaskan, or aircraft to the Alaskan, is like automobiles or trucks are to people here. They depend on them. This is the only mode of transportation that many of them have. And it's an emergency system, too, for medical treatment for villagers and those that work out. The industries are varied in Alaska. There's mining and trapping. These are some of the major things. The fisheries are very prolific there. They bring in a lot of revenue to the state. But now, some of the more interesting trips, I would say, or one of them especially, was in March. They have a carnival in Fairbanks, and they have dog races there. I probably have told you this. There's a little village to the west, about 40 miles from Fairbanks, and I was given the job of flying two Alaskan Huskies back to Minto for this Eskimo boy. He'd just finished his races there. So they gave me a little airplane, 150 Cessna. And I looked these dogs over, and they're pretty good size, and one of them's frolicking and frisking around, and he's bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and I thought, well, now you are going to go in the baggage compartment. This other fellow, he was kind of quiet, and I put him up in the seat next to me.
Let's describe how big this thing is, this airplane.
All right, 150 Cessna. Now, it's very small. Two people sitting side by side touch their shoulders in this airplane. It's powered by a 100-horse engine. It doesn't have any great rate of climb, but it's a nice little airplane. It's comfortable and warm. Well, we put this dog in the front seat and one in the baggage compartment, and everything's going along just fine. And we come into Mento, and on the downwind leg, everything goes loose on this dog. He's all over the cockpit. First, he's over on top of me, then he's on the dashboard, then he's back down in the floor, and finally he props himself up with his feet and up in the dash with his stomach on the yoke. And here I am trying to fly this airplane. It looks like a porpoise going downwind. And he decides to stay there, so that's fine. As long as he's still, everything's going along pretty good. Well, we finally managed to get the airplane on the ground after a few bounces, and that was one little experience there. Nothing serious, nothing happened, no incident. That was not too much of a thrill. And some of these others, some of these other flights, they become a little hairy at times.
Let's take a break here. It's 25 before 9 o'clock. This is WJMA's airline program on WJMA, AM and FM in Orange. And we'll be back in just a minute.
Virginia, we'd like to say, we're with you all the way. 'Cause we believe in you. We're proud to be called First Virginia Band.
Spring's here. What do you need? Maybe a new car or tractor, seed or fertilizer, a new roof for your home. Maybe you're redecorating. Whatever your need is, whether for your farm or home or business, we're ready to give you the best deal around on financing. Here at First Virginia Bank of Orange, we like to do business with you. We're even open Saturdays till noon. Member FDIC.
Virginia, we like to say, we're with you all the way. 'Cause we believe in you. We're proud to be called First Virginia Bank.
24 before 9 o'clock on WJMA's airline. I'm Russ Roberts. We're talking with my dad, who is an ex-Alaskan bush pilot, and that's the subject, flying in Alaska. And he's telling us about some of his more memorable flights.
Yes, well, there's another flight that sticks in my mind that it wasn't much fun. There are many low-frequency ranges in Alaska. These are navigational facilities. They're obsolete here in the United States. There are probably several left in Alaska because of the high mountain range where high-frequency radios don't work too well, the Omni ranges. So they still have a few. But they're unmanned, and they're operated with diesel generators. So once in a while, we have to take the FAA men out to these sites, and generally there's a place to land close by. The one that, on this particular day, it's wintertime now, and there's snow on the ground, and it's rather cold. I believe it was sleeting a little bit. It wasn't extremely cold. When it gets real cold, usually the weather's pretty good. It's clear. But it was raining a little bit. This radio low-frequency range was south of Fairbanks, about 80 miles. And we proceeded to leave Fairbanks in a 172 Cessna. That's a four-place aircraft with a nose wheel. Not too much power for four big men. And there were two airports at this little low-frequency range. One was down along a creek bed, and one was up on top closer to the range station, and this is the one we decided to land on, although it was a shorter strip. Well, we landed without any trouble. There was about 4 inches of soft snow on this runway, and it had a drop on about the middle way of it, about 3 feet. It rolled off, of course, that wasn't so bad. But we parked the airplane. I taxied it back up and parked it at the other end of the strip, and we walked up to the range station and checked everything out. It took about an hour, I suppose, to do all of this. When we came back, the airplane had ice all over the wings. Well, there wasn't much there to get this ice off with. Usually you put a bag over it with a heater, you know, and melt the ice, or you put these wing covers on it before you leave. But we didn't have anything like that there with us. So I scrape it off the best I can, and I'm looking at this strip with 4 inches of snow and these three big fellows in there and me, and I'm wondering about this strip. It was about 1,200 feet. That's not too long, you know, for all this weight, especially with snow on the ground. But I get to thinking about this little dip. I said, boy, that'll probably throw me right off, and I'll be airborne. Well, it didn't work. We got to that dip, and I thought I'd chop the power when I got there, you know, and try it again. But it didn't work. I got to this dip, and it was almost flying. The stall warning was squealing, and I decided to keep it going. It was just about on the verge of flying. Well, we ran out of runway. Of course, we were on top of this knoll, and there were brush at the end of the strip, and then it dropped right straight off down into 1,000 feet below. Well, needless to say, my heart was in my mouth about this time. I couldn't say anything. I felt like I had cotton in there. But with the stall warning squealing, I managed to bounce it off and drop down over this side of this mountain. And we picked up enough flying speed to keep it going. Well, that was an incident there that didn't appeal to my passengers, being FAA men, and I think one of them was a pilot. And he didn't exactly like that. I didn't either, to tell you the truth, but there wasn't anything I could do about it. We got back to the airport, and they told the boss, they said, we don't want him for a pilot anymore. So they didn't fly with me anymore. But that's just the kind of flying once in a while you run into. If you don't leave while the engine's warm, you won't get the airplane started. It gets too cold. There was a flight that went further south. This was a pass down through the Mount McKinley Range. Now, we're flying close to the Mount McKinley area now. There's a railroad that runs from Fairbanks to Anchorage, and this is a low pass through these mountains. And there's two mines down through here. They're coal mines, and we had regular runs into Usabelli and Lignite. And on further down was the base of the Mount McKinley Park, and they had a maintenance station there, and they had a school for the children. And a nurse had to go down and give them some shots one day. There was a pass that we go through. They call it Windy Pass, just before you get into Cantwell. And the wind happened to be blowing that day. There was glazed ice on the highway, and that's where we landed, by the way, on the roads. And it was a crosswind. And it was about 50 knots, diagonally across. And I was in a Navion, and just one passenger. And we get the airplane on the ground just fine. No difficulty there. Navion's a pretty good old airplane. It's heavy and good and stable. But now we have to turn this airplane around and taxi back up to the school. So, now remember, the road's ice all over it, and the wind's blowing across it, and it's crowned a little. Well, I have to go off to the left of the highway just a little to make the turn. And when I did, it put the right wing up. Well, the wind slid this big old airplane right off of the road into a snowbank, and it dropped down about 2 feet. Well, there I was stuck. And it was 40 below zero. Well, I jump out of the airplane, I shut it off, and run up and get a truck for this nurse to get up to the school, and then they were going to come down and pull me out of the ditch. Well, about 20 minutes had lapsed now since I'd cut the engine off. Well, during this time, the engine got a little cold, and we got it back on the road. I was going to turn it around and taxi back and then take off. The road turned and went on down through this pass, and it was kind of curvy. So I started the engine. It didn't want to start. It was cold and just almost didn't turn over. So it finally caught, and it's spitting and sputtering and carrying on. I reached down for the brake. I'm going to hold it for a little while, you know, before...
It'll warm up, right?
Let it warm up. But no brake. Now, the Navion's got a hand brake, and both of them are together. There's no tow brakes on this airplane. Well, there's no brake. No brakes at all. And it's beginning to creep on me and start to roll. Well, I didn't have any choice. I didn't want to shut it down and start all over again. So I firewalled it. And away we go. Down through the highway and around the curve and finally get it in the air, sputtering and carrying on. Well, that's a time that you don't know whether it's going to fly or not. But thank goodness it took off and we managed to get back. I didn't make my stop at Usabelli. We had some passengers waiting there. I got back to Fairbanks and there was no incident there. It was without any problem. What happened, when it went over in the ditch, it pulled the hydraulic line out of the little B-nut that it fits into the left cylinder. But that was just one of those little things that happened quite frequently, one way or another. Some of the interesting things that bringing wrecked airplanes back out of the Thule's. Down here in Nenana, and that's just a place on the railroad, there's a big lake. And some of the people have cabins down there, and they go down there in the wintertime to do the fishing.
This is about, what, 50 miles southwest of Fairbanks?
No, about 40, 45 miles, something like that. Of course, now, remember, in Alaska, there's an awful lot of airplanes. People use them like automobiles. In fact, 25% of the population in Alaska own aircraft. They have the highest accident rate in the world, too, up there. By the way. But anyway, this fella fell through the ice, broke nose wheel off a Cessna 175. Well, it had to sit there until winter, all summer long. There was no way to get it out, so he landed on the ice and he couldn't get it out. There's no roads, there's nothing, no means.
Landing on ice was common in the winter, right?
Oh, yes, well, that's the way they do it with wheels or skis. Go ice fishing, and you land on the river at the villages. It's nice and smooth. Of course, once in a while, you will fall through the ice if it's rotten, decayed ice. But this airplane had a broken nose wheel, and he tipped it up and dented the right wing, I guess almost back to the aileron. Of course, that was bent a little bit, too. Well, we waited till winter time and flew down. A mechanic and I, and we wired this nose wheel back on this 175. All Cessnas, that's the first thing that goes when the nose wheel hits a little rock or a ditch. The thing pulls off of the firewall, and there you go down, bend your prop up. Well, we wired it back on with some baling wire, put a new prop on it, and I guess that's about all we had to do. Started it up. It didn't want to start too easy, but we got it going. By the way, it took about 3 hours, and it was pretty cold. I guess it was around zero that day, and the wind was blowing. I about froze by the time we got this thing ready to fly. Well, I get in it, and it's okay. We managed to get back, and those wheel held. I had to fly with the stick about 90 degrees in one direction. It was that much out of rig. But that was... a pretty good little experience flying these wrecked airplanes. Sometimes you don't fly them. You land on these gold tailings, many cases. People use airplanes for fishing or anything, and just anything their hearts desire, go hunting or whatever.
What's a gold tailing?
Gold tailing is a lot of rocks piled up by a big dredge. The FE company, Federal Electric Company, had these big monstrous dredges that would crush these stones up, and it would sift the gold out and collect it. And they would pipe water for miles over the mountains, and this thing floated like a boat. And it would put these rocks off to one side. And they'd set a caterpillar upon them and level them out. And this is what they'd make runways out of. Well, in many places, you'd look off to the right side or the left side, and there's a crashed airplane, a skeleton, just laid over there. We went fishing one time. We didn't get to go fishing, but that's where we were started. You fly in this canyon and you do a wing over and set it down on these tailings, and this is how you do up there. But these are some of the mild experiences of bush flying. We landed in places where trappers have beat out with their snowshoes, little short 800-foot strips to bring him supplies. We'd take him back into these places and leave him, and then several months later we'd go back and take supplies to them. And our regular runs were down to the coal mines down in Usabelli and in that direction. But once in a while we get trips further out. There was a trip I never will forget. This was a real experience. The airlines were not flying. Juneau was closed in, and that's where this man had to go. He had a big contract pending, and he had to be there in person. And the weather was bad all the way. And they gave me a little airplane. They thought that's what we ought to have. We could wind in and out the mountains easier.
What was it?
It was a 150 Cessna. All it had in it was a needle, speedle, and airball.
Mm-hmm.
No instruments, and the radio wasn't much good. It was you couldn't get anybody with those VOR radios. You're down in the mountains all the time. The ceiling was about 400 feet, and we were flying 200 off of the ground, up and down the canyons and around, and very strong headwind. We landed at Northway, refueled, and I had big tanks. I had about 7 hours of fuel on this airplane. And it was drizzling rain, and it was starting to get dark. I remember very well this particular night. When it got dark, there was no visual contact with the ground. And you could look up and you could see the clouds. They looked like they were right on top of you. They were black and it was blowing, and we were flying over this inlet just short of Juneau. And the only way that I could tell where we were by the chart was to look at the beacons on the water. They had lights there.
You've flown all the way from Fairbanks to Juneau now, but you're not quite there.
No, not
quite
right there.
You're all the way from Fairbanks.
Oh, yeah.
How far is that?
That was about, I guess that was close to 600 miles. And we'd been in the air about 8 hours now. And we had some strong winds. And I kept looking down and wondering, where am I going to put this airplane if I can't find that airport, if I can't get over there? There was a big bluff that was between the water and the airport, and the airport was down on the other side of this bluff. Of course, I couldn't see it. And I kept looking down. Once in a while, I would see a car light, and I thought, well, maybe I could set it down on the road if I had to. Well, there came up a fjord, you know, opening a body of water. It was about 5 miles across there. And actually, there was no visual reference whatsoever, and I had to go on instruments, hoping that I didn't fly into the drink with this thing. And finally we got to the shore again, and then I picked up the shoreline, and everything was felt better then, a little bit anyway. But I was still a little nervous. I tried to be calm, cool, you know. I had a passenger over here. I tried to talk to him and make him feel comfortable, but I don't know. It seemed like he was getting a little bit uneasy, too. I guess the prettiest sight in the world was that night when I saw this marker light on top of this cliff. And I slipped up over top of this light, and down on the other side were those runway lights. And I'd been calling this airport for an hour, and nobody would answer. I landed the airplane, taxied up and parked it and tied it down, and went into the operations, and there wasn't anybody around. They were all in the back room drinking coffee or something like that. And they said, "Where'd you come from?" Well, I said, "I dropped in out of the sky here." They said, "The field's closed." I said, "It might be, but I'm here." And it was a beautiful sight, though, to see those lights strung out there. And had it made then, felt good about that. Well, the next day, the weather wasn't any better, and we were going back. So we take off again, full of fuel now, and I decided to go by Fort Yukon. That's by the railroad. I was going to fly IFR, you know. I followed the railroad along here. Mm-hmm. Well, the railroad goes up a mountain, and the ceiling is rather low yet. And I'm looking at this mountain, and I see a wedge at the top, and I see a little light shining through it. It's a V cut out, you know, and clouds are above it. And we're going up, climbing about 300 feet a minute, going up with the terrain, churning along, and the wings are getting closer and closer to these mountain sides, the right and the left. Here it is, getting tighter and tighter up in here. And just about the time we get close to the top, this pass closes over solid. Of course, you don't go through there. You can't see. You go into the mountain, you know, so there's no way to turn it around. There we were, boxed in. Well, the only thing to do was roll it on its back and pull it out at the bottom. And that's what we did. Of course, the passenger, he didn't like it too well, but that's the only way. Well, the trip back was just like the one going down. It was nasty all the way, and really tires you out when you're flying like that. It's fatiguing. But there's many a beautiful flight where you just sit there and look at the country, and you see many beautiful sights flying in Alaska when the weather's pretty. We stopped at a campsite. Remember Lake Lukwani?
Yeah, right.
That was a beautiful lake, about 35 miles along the road. And we spent the night there, very comfortable in a little rag tent.
This was on our way up.
On our way up.
Right.
So one day while I was flying along, I looked down along this lake, and there were 11 brown bear down there, right close to the campsite we stayed at. Mm-hmm. And on down a little bit further, two more across the a runway at the other end of this lake. And a great day. Here we were down there having a big time, not knowing what was around us. They took our guns away too, you know.
This was in Canada.
They wouldn't let us take those through, and I thought, I don't like that much. But anyway, we managed to get up there all right. Those are a couple experiences that are memorable. They probably always stick in my mind as flying in Alaska. You can fly along and see moose down in the flats and the delta sections, sticking their heads under the water, eating vegetation. You can fly along the McKinley Mountain Range and see goats and sheep. One experience was very nice. We flew down to Talkeetna in a wheeled airplane and landed. And Bob Shelton was a bush pilot there, and he had a float plane. And we went fishing back in a little creek. He carried us back there, just a 5-minute jump in his float plane, and we had a nice time fishing rainbow trout and salmon. I guess that was about the best fishing trip I'd had. while I was up there. Bob Shelton, by the way, is a world-famous bush pilot. They call him a glacier pilot. He's the one that takes these mountain climbers up to their base camp, and then he keeps check on them as they're climbing Mount McKinley. And the airplane he uses is a Super Cub. It's got dope on it, but they don't put any color on it because of the extra weight.
This dope is just to stretch the fabric out so it's tight.
All right. Yeah, you have to clear these things up.
That's right.
Okay. And he flies up this mountain and lands on these glaciers up there and keeps check on these mountain climbers. This is something I'd never done. We flew wheel skis a lot. I didn't fly any floats while I was in Alaska. Most of it was on wheels or skis in the wintertime. The best flying, I guess, is in the winter. Summertime is good flying in Alaska, but it does get a little soggy once in a while in the summer. Wintertime, there's a little snow once in a while. Of course, the snow is not bad. You can always see straight down. You can't see out too well. One little trip we took, we had a day when it was snowing, and they wanted to go over to Gold King. This was one of those satellite places that was in connection with that Clear radar site, and they had to check on their generators, and it was called Gold King, and they just scraped off a runway at the top of a mountain. Well, by the time we got close to the mountains, now you've got to visualize here now, from Fairbanks south, it's a big flat delta. It's just flat country. That it looked like maybe the Tanana River may have made this big delta stretch through here. And it goes all the way to the mountain range, the McKinley or Alaska mountain range. And this is kind of brackets you in south, and the railroad brackets you in west, but there's some cat trails that's caterpillar trails that along the base of this mountain range that they worked in to get the equipment there to build this runway. Once the runway was built, then they could fly everything in and out. But they walked those cats across 35 or 40 miles of this tundra to get them over to this site. Now, it was...
We got to tell them who we are here, and we'll be right back. This is WJMA, AM and FM in Orange. Let's take about a minute break, and we'll be back.
Hey, when's the last time you made a wish?
I wish I could get an angiometry.
I wish for a place to live.
I wish I was in Omaha with my grandmother and grandfather.
Wishing is very important, you know.
I think I wish for all the children in the world to be well and healthy and have enough to eat.
I wish I could lose 100 pounds.
I wish I had a bike.
My wish is for good health.
Wishing means you hope for better things.
I wish we could find solutions to the crime problem.
I wish that we win every soccer game in our league.
I wish, and I really wish, the price of food would go down.
If you want hope, you've got to make a wish.
If I have one wish, it's to understand my children.
I wish that everything works out between my boyfriend and me.
I just wish for a job.
I wish all the lost children would come home to their fathers.
Because without a wish, there can be no hope.
Yeah, I wish there were more love and truth and less loneliness in the world.
From the Franciscans, with love.
This is the airline program. It's 3 minutes after 9 o'clock. I'm Russ Roberts, talking with my dad, Dudley Roberts, who is talking about bush flying in Alaska. And we are now describing the area you were flying into and how they made these runways, I guess, right?
Yes.
All right.
So this area now is a big delta flat, and it stretches about 60 miles south, just as flat as it can be, and the ceiling can get down to 200 feet, and you can still fly safely until you come to the mountain range. Well, this is the way we find ourselves when the weather's kind of bad. You bracket yourself in one way or the other. Well, Gold King was right on the edge of the mountains. It was high up. They stationed these sites up to get a better advantage over the terrain. So it was snowing, and the visibility was poor. You couldn't see out too well this day, and had three men in a 180 Cessna. We had wheel skis on it. I figured that I'd fly straight south, and if I drifted right or left a little bit, it'd be all right. I could hit these cat trails and follow them to the site. Well, this is what I did, but when I got to the mountains, it was snowing snowflakes as big as half a dollar. You couldn't see anything except straight down. But I made a turn and started following this cat trail, looking down, and I happened to see the antenna sticking up. But there was about 3 foot of new snow on the runway. You couldn't tell where the runway was. You couldn't even tell there was a runway there. It was all white. Of course, snow makes a white out, really. You can't tell the ground from the sky. But a line up where I thought the runway was, and bring it in, set it up on a rate of descent. And sure enough, there we touched down. You didn't exactly feel it. The only way you knew you were down, you got covered with snow. Well, after we touched down, we come to an abrupt stop, almost. Had to firewall it full bore to taxi up to this utility house that they had there. And I cut it off, go in for a little while, and we were there about an hour, I guess. We'll come back out, airplane won't move. Stuck. It buried itself in the snow, you know, so the men got out, and I'm firewalling this thing, and they're rocking and pushing and carrying on. Snow's covering them up, you know, out there with that blast of the prop. Finally, they break it loose, and then while it's running, they're trying to climb back in the airplane. I'm kind of dragging them a little bit along, you know. They finally get in the airplane. I'm flying, trying to get this thing off the ground. It won't go. I couldn't even pick up airspeed enough to even get the airspeed indicator to move. So down the runway I go, nothing. I have to turn around. Do the same thing back up, full power, nothing. I had to do this about 7 or 8 times, and finally it decided it would lift itself off after about 7 times. You try to stay in the same tracks, you know, and beat it down to a point. Of course, all this time you can't see anything. You're just... You got your head out the window trying to see your tracks, you know, each time. And this was another little venture there that I'll remember. You don't have these too often. But like I say, out of the hundreds of flights in Alaska, these are just a few with incidents to them, you know, that you wonder whether you're going to make it or not. There are several other little flights I had there. Don't know if people are interested in it.
I'm sure they are.
Perhaps the country itself might be of interest to them. So many tales have been told about Alaska that many people have a wrong impression of the country. Actually, the city of Fairbanks is just like any other city. It has a university. A fine university there, and there's stores, Safeway stores, and I guess they have a Market Basket. Used to be some kind of pig store.
Piggly Wiggly.
Piggly Wiggly, yeah, that's...
big chain out west, that's...
Right.
I don't know if we have any Piggly Wigglies around here or not.
Don't think so. I think they changed the name, didn't they?
Yeah, they called it Market Basket, but there's still Piggly Wigglies in Los Angeles.
I guess. They have big commercial stores. One big department store pair called Northern Commercial. They have a lot of saloons and theaters. And just like any other town, it's got a lot of people, around 10,000 people.
More than that now, though. They've grown 25,000 since we left.
I guess so. But this was just the civilians, not counting the military personnel.
Right.
So I guess they have increased in population. Well, There was a little flight that I was taking for the Safeway stores, and this was going north now. Most all of these little incidences were flying south. But there's a place called Rampart, northwest. You have to cross a few little mountains. I guess you call them mountains. They're 5,000 feet or so. They're nothing like McKinley Mountain. But it's on the Yukon River, and they have a fishery there. And this man catches salmon at certain times of the year, sockeye salmon. We used to bring these salmon back for the Safeway store. We would go in here, this runway now, it was only about 1,000 feet, and it was only a one-way runway. You flew in one way, and you flew out the same way you flew in. And we'd load this 180 up with 1,000 pounds of salmon. They would be in the back and then piled up beside you in your seat beside you, big sacks of salmon. And off you go, out there across the Yukon. One sputter, and that's all she wrote, she'd be in a drink. But everything was always to the maximum, it seemed. You used that airplane like a truck, and you loaded it up to where you couldn't get any more in it. You remember me talking about Yucabeli, the coal mine. Well, we used to carry cat parts in there quite frequently. And this airplane, now, this first time I was ever introduced to this airplane was an Navion. The man said, you know how to fly an Navion? I said, well, I've never flown one. He said, well, get in it, and I'll go around the pattern with you. So he gets in it. He shows me where the buttons and knobs and things are in it, you know, in the gear. And that's all it was to it. So then they load it up for me. I'm going to Yucabeli. They keep putting cat parts in till the tail touches the ground. Now, this is a nose wheel airplane. The nose wheel comes off the ground. The only way you could get the nose wheel back down on the ground was rev the engine up and hold the brakes. Well, here we are, about 500 pounds over gross, and all, it seemed like all of it was in the tail. Well, I stagger out of Phillips Field there in Fairbanks, and boy, I thought I had a bomb, man. It just felt like it wasn't going to go up at all. It just drug out over the city, just barely climbing, and I was afraid to turn it. That's just how heavy it felt, you know. Well, I drag out across these flats, and I'm gaining a little bit of altitude, you know. Now, there's two ways to go into Yucabeli. You could fly the railroad, or you could cut through the mountain, which was about 20 minutes shorter. So, naturally, everybody wanted to go through the mountain, and that's the way we generally went. So I stick my nose in here, in these mountains now, with this big load of parts on this thing, and it starts to snow. Well, now, you know, I'm afraid to turn this airplane. It's so heavy. You're flying right next to the mountains, you know. You're down in the canyons, zooming around, trying to navigate through here. But I didn't like that snow. And with this heavy airplane, I'm afraid to turn. I couldn't turn sharp, you know. And what to do? There I'm sitting in the mountains now, and turn the airplane around.